Well, no matter what the season or the weather, insects are all around us all the time. And you know what? They're fascinating creatures. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, and great to have Phil Pelletieri with us, entomologist. He's a distinguished faculty associate emeritus, extension emeritus, and former retired head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Phil, always great to see you. Thanks
so much.
Nice
to be here, Larry.
Really great to have you come by. What are some insects that we might be seeing outdoors starting now and going into fall?
Well, you know, considering in much of the state it's been a little bit on the dry side, I'm seeing lots of crickets and grasshoppers and tree crickets and all those kind of fun things. And I, especially the grasshoppers, associate them with doing better in somewhat dry seasons. The other thing I think to start keeping in mind is those ones that want to come in your house in the fall, things like cluster flies and Western conifer seed bugs and box elder bugs are going to start congregating in the next week or two. And so for people who have historically had some problems with that, it's time to keep your eyes open, because many times the quicker you get after it in the late summer, early fall, the better chance you have of success of keeping them outdoors.
Seems like I in particular, at least, have been seeing a lot more grasshoppers this year.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty much found throughout Wisconsin, are they not?
Yeah, and we have a large number of species. I don't know. The shorthorn grasshoppers, I'm guessing we're probably somewhere in the 30, 40 species. And for most, not all, but most species, they spend the winter as eggs. So the winter extremes don't affect them much because they're down in the soil and well protected. What seems to have the biggest effect on populations is when they hatch, and usually the soil has to be reasonably warm. So we're talking early June. If we have excessive rains, be honest, they don't do well. The young nymphs flood and get sick and all kinds of things. In dry years, it goes the other way. That's when we have. In fact, when you talk about significant grasshopper populations, it usually takes two or three summer droughts in a row to get the buildup that we need. And once they become adults, they get kind of frustrating because they can fly. And because they can fly, they can move big distances and cause people some real problems, both in the garden and, you know, one of the interesting complaints I'd get is they chew on plastic screens and eat through the screens on people's houses, or in some cases eat the paint off the houses. And, you know, nutritionally that doesn't make any sense, but that doesn't mean they don't do it. So.
Yeah, they do it anyway. Are those primary grasshoppers that we're likely to see, are they native to the Midwest, or are they?
Yes. We really don't. Even the ones that move around and quote, you know, in the plagues and the like, for the most part, can be found locally, although traditionally the bigger grasshopper problems are drier and west of us. But we do once in a while get outbreaks. And it's been probably, close to 15 years before we really had the kind of you know, decimate field type populations and stuff. And so they said we wouldn't anticipate that without a couple very dry summers to build, and lighter soils, it's always more common because they drain better and those kind of things.
Yeah. And they eat pretty much anything from the sound of it.
Yeah. Well, you know, kind of general feeders. And, you know, so a lot of times they're breeding in weedy areas, but when the weeds start to dry out and the like, then they will migrate. And of course the big green patches are irrigated areas, whether it's your lawn or your garden, or in some cases agricultural fields.
And you're sort of hitting at their life cycle, or mentioned pieces of it. What is the life cycle?
Well, one generation a year. Generally, the female will lay a clutch of eggs that kind of look like a bunch of rice grains to me into the soil, usually the late summer. And then the spring, those critters hatch and they're on their own and go from there. Now, we do have a couple species that spend the winter. The post-oak grasshopper spends the winter as adults. So, you know, it is possible to see adult grasshoppers in the spring, but not many do it. I said most of them are this, spend the winter as eggs and go through one generation in a year and mature sometime from July on. And then we'll see them until, usually the frost comes.
And do they, they do some damage to agricultural crops, I would think, a little at least.
Yeah, potentially. But they have to really gang up on plants. I mean, we're talking something like 15, 20 grasshoppers on a corn plant before you see significant problems. But again, what's frustrating is a lot of times, even if you were to do something to knock them off, if you've got the wrong conditions next to you, more come migrating in a couple, 3 days. So, you know, when we start seeing densities of 5 to 10 per square yard, that's getting pretty serious.
And so in terms of control, when they can just fly in, it's
very... Yeah, well, you know, there's things that can affect the plant. Sometimes farmers get away with just doing the margins because that's where they're migrating out from.
Oh, okay.
You know, it kind of depends on the situation. But when you get area-wide outbreaks, it's kind of a hard-to-win situation.
So there are some chemicals that can...
Oh, yeah, they're really not hard to kill. And there are some natural diseases, but the diseases are more weather-dependent. And again, it seems when it's dry, the diseases are not as much of a factor.
Well, Phil, we have lots of callers online and... lots of Facebook photos. This is going to be fun show. I'm really looking forward to what everybody has to say. And Steve in Mineral Point up first with a question for you. Hi, Steve. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. Your show is real timely because I came home yesterday and discovered I have a problem. Started about a week ago. My wife noticed that there were some bees going into our house where the satellite cables ran into the house. And, of course, she asked me to plug that hole, and naturally I procrastinated and haven't done it.
Good. Phil's very happy about that. Okay. do you know if they're honeybees or do they appear they're black and yellow and they could be yellow jackets?
Well, they look like honeybees, but they're a little bigger. And what I found yesterday is when I came home, we have our master bedroom in the basement, and they have actually chewed through the half-inch drywall into our basement.
Okay, and so...
I found about 50 of them near the windows.
Okay, I want you to look at them real close, and if they appear what I would say is brownish and they're fuzzy, they're a honeybee. If they're black and yellow and appear maybe just to have a few black spines, they're a yellow jacket. And it is important to tell the difference because the strategy is going to be a little different. The other thing you might be able to pick up on is if they chewed through, the yellow jackets are a paper wasp. So you have this grayish carton from the nest present. Whereas honeybees, you would expect comb, which is, you know, waxy and it's got honey built into it. The reason why it's important is because the yellow jackets will eventually die out and you'll be done with them by the 1st of November. Now, it doesn't sound like you can wait that long, but whereas the honeybees, that colony can go for years. And so the winter will not solve the problem under any circumstance. Why I was excited about your comments about not plugging. If you plugged, I honestly expect you to make the problem much worse because they're going to try to get out and who knows where they're going to come and they're not going to be happy. Whereas if you let them go through their normal procedures, you're fine. What I tend to like to use for treatments is to use a dust in that opening that they're coming and going from. You blow the dust in there, and typically you'd want to do it in a good cool morning or, you know, in the evening when the sun's just going down because things should settle down. And the dilemma with dust, it doesn't kill them instantly, but it performs far better within a matter of a few hours. Usually the colony is wiped out. And when they come and go through the opening, they get the dust on their bodies. That's why it works. Whereas what I tend to find with the aerosol sprays, if the true nest is a number of feet away from where they're coming and going, you really get very little control when you use these wash sprays. And so, you know, is this something you're going to have to be on a ladder to do?
Well, a step ladder. I mean, I think where they're coming in from the outside is actually around the foundation.
Ah, okay. Well, then,
of course, where they're coming through the ceiling, you'd have to use a stepladder to.
But I think if you treat the outside entrance where they're coming and going, and just let that take care of itself naturally, you'll be done. And now the only question is, you know, sometimes the physical hole is hard to get the dust into. Sometimes it's worth sacrificing a turkey baster or something else to blow the dust. They do sell something called a bulb duster sometimes at the hardware stores, which has got like a little straw on the bottom. And it's like a little bellows, which can be used. You know, and if it looks to be something that maybe you're not really comfortable with, you can always get a pest control service. But it's not necessary because, you know, what they use isn't going to be a whole lot different. It's just that, you know, in some cases, they'll come in with bee suits. But, you know, one of the dilemmas is you as a homeowner can do it anytime. Pest control services tend to come in the middle of the day. And where I find that to be a little problematic is that the workers that are out and about, when they come back, they will refuse to go in the hole and they get kind of agitated. So I'd rather have them all surrounded by doing the very early morning or evening treatments than when you do it in the middle of the day when, as I said, then there are some spin-off problems for the couple of days afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this dust is something I can buy at most retail stores?
Yeah. What you're looking for is a garden dust. And there are numerous ones. 7 was an old standby. They use permethrin dusts. And as I said, in this case, it's the formulation more than the specific chemical. But these are common yard and garden dust is what you're after.
Now, if it's a honeybee, would you, is there a way to?
So the honeybee, a couple complications. Even if you were to kill the bees, then you still have the honey. And so you literally have to open the wall and remove all that accumulated honey and wax. If you don't, it can ferment and leak through. It draws things like raccoons and skunks. And honestly, if there's another honeybee colony in the next 4 or 5 years cruising around looking for a place to move in, they're attracted to the old comb. Now, if you're lucky enough to have a beekeeper close by, sometimes, not always, but sometimes they can kind of recycle most of these bees. They can set up a hive next to it and kind of draw them off and the like. So it's always worth checking if you've got any local beekeeping associations. Many times they're county-based. And if you know you've got honeybees, see if there's anybody there that's interested in giving you a help. And again, their help is going to be more to recycle the bees, not necessarily to control the problem. But if they get most of the bees out there, it makes it easier. But as I said, that's why I went back to my first comment. It really is important. And if you're not sure, you can take some pictures, you know, and send them to me or send them to PJ now, who's PJ Leash, who's now running the diagnostic lab. And then we can be sure. And it won't take that fancy of a picture for us to tell the difference if you're not comfortable with the ID.
Frankly, if you've got something now, you could just put it up on my Facebook page. We'll take a look at it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate your help, and I love the show. Thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, and Loretta in Eau Claire. It's her turn. Hi, Loretta.
Hi. I had a yellow jacket emergency last summer and had to have an ambulance and everything. But there are yellow jackets underneath our mailbox. We have some decorative logs on end, and they've dried and weathered and cracked. And there is an active yellow jacket nest inside the crack.
Mm-hmm.
And a sweet neighbor came and used what he loves to use is some expanding foam sort of thing meant for to be a pesticide, and he sprayed there, but there numbers are knocked down, but there's still some workers there, and I imagine the queen's in there.
Mm-hmm.
You had suggested at one time using 7.
Yes.
And I'm not sure how you get in there. Would you use that turkey baster thing?
Yeah, the same thing, or an old mustard bottle, or sometimes, you know, if it's just a hole that you can sprinkle down into, the container is fine. It's the problem when you have to blow it up that you need some kind of device to aid in getting it in.
They get in. Then should someone besides myself do this?
Yes.
Yes.
just because, you know, why take the risk if you know you're allergic? And so, as I said, typically it's going to be a little tough as finding cool weather from what the weather people are saying in the next 5 or 6 days. But as I said, right away at sunrise, or usually I'll go out right now, I would say probably around 8 o'clock or so, to treat the nest. And as I said, you just dust where they're coming and going, and you really don't have to do a whole lot more and just leave it in. And by noon the next day, anything that has survived. The only important point in this case is if some of the normal areas were plugged up, they might be coming out somewhere else. So you're almost worth having somebody sit back and just observe where they seem to be active from, because you've got to have that spot marked so that you can dust that mm-hmm. particular spot.
Yep. Do you still want the 7 driven in with garden hose water?
No. I just want it to be in the entrance so when they're coming and going,
it's
they get
dust.
It on their body.
Yeah, you want it dusty.
Yeah, but see, you know, sometimes the problem is it's a void. There's a space in there, and, you know, you don't have to blow it feet deep, but I want it in the void, not just on the outside. As I said, I want to make sure that the critters, when they come and go, get in contact with it.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the fascinating world of insects with entomologist Phil Pelletieri, and Dennis and Rippon up next with a question. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for calling.
Hi. You had started out talking about grasshoppers and crickets, and I'm probably one of the few people who are glad to see more of them because I found that trout just love them.
Ah.
Yeah, You know, native baits, I can see where their trout would be very excited. The trouble is, I think sometimes it's keeping them on the hook. But other than that.
That is the problem.
Yeah.
What do you do, tie them on?
No. I usually just kind of thread them on. And they usually don't last long, but there's enough of them, then you can change
them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There you go. Good bait for trout. We're going to be doing a show on trout coming up. An author of a book on trout, which is a fantastic book. The guy goes out, he'll catch 20 or 25 in a couple hours along many of the Wisconsin streams, trout streams.
Well, I find some of the best aquatic entomologists are not entomologists, they're people that fish trout, because they pay far more attention to these hatches and the various little subtleties. And there's all kinds of interesting animals in the streams, and in the better the water quality, the more interesting they are, and of course, the better it is for trout. So it's kind of a fun thing. But a lot of times I'm asked questions by people that are real serious trout fishermen that it's above my head. I mean,
Aaron in Humboldt, Iowa, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have something that I think is called a blue mud dauber. I think that's what it's called.
Sure.
I'm sorry?
Yes, I'm aware of the critter.
Yeah, I guess everything I've read about them, they're not aggressive, and they're solitary. They're not usually such a problem. But I've got such a huge number of them that they're becoming a problem. I can't get my dog to leave them alone, and she comes in covered with bites all the time. Is there some way? I put a grub killer down every fall, and that kind of helps to cut it back a little bit, but they continue to get worse and worse every year.
Okay, so let's make sure, because there's a couple things that look very similar. Are they critters that burrow into the ground, or are they critters that make little mud tubes up in your overhangs?
If they're in the overhangs, I don't see them.
Okay.
I've never seen them actually digging into the ground either.
Okay, well,
I have wicked decks that they could very easily be inside of.
Okay, so it's going to take a little detective work. The mud daubers construct these little mud tubes. They go out and collect spiders, stuff them in there and seal them off, and then their grubs raise themselves. And so usually you get these clusters, and in by nature they like it kind of high. So you usually see them on, you know, second story overhangs and the like. And but in the late summer, we also have some other thread-waisted wasps that are a big blue metallic. The cricket hunters are one species, but we have other ones. And what they'll do is go out and dig a small burrow in the ground, and they'll collect a great big green grasshopper or somebody else and stuff it in there. And then, again, the reason these solitary wasps are considered more docile is that's not really called a nest. I mean, we call it a burrower, like, versus something like a yellow jacket, where we've got a few thousand that are all living in the nest. And then those are much more aggressive when the nest is threatened. But the ultimate solution here is, if one finds out where they are creating these burrows to raise their young, that's what needs to be treated. And, you know, for the ground nesting cricket hunters, you just, again, dust into the little holes that they go into. It works quite well. For the mud daubers, honestly, the aerosols work pretty well, but you'd have to see where the nests are located. So it may be worth just kind of peeking when they seem to disappear underneath a deck, if you can make anything out of it. Or it may just be that they're attacking the soil and they're making these burrows in the soil underneath the deck. And then you know that that's where you can treat be done with it from there.
Yep.
You know, you've got another 4 to 6 weeks probably of activity for either of those species. So it may just be to make life a little easier on your dog is to treat. But as I said, that would be my advice, is just dig a little deeper so that you have kind of an educated guess of where you need to treat.
Thanks for calling, Aaron. Appreciate it. Greg in Manches, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. I live in the country and have a lot of hornets and wasps that build nests. And I've seen a dust applicator for the use of 7 that's just like an 8-foot pipe with attached to an air compressor. Do you know where one can get a schematic for a design like that?
Honestly, one of the things you might look at, because you'd get the idea of the commercial ones that are out there, is go to some place like Do Your Own Pest Control and look at the devices and see if, you know, they can give you enough detail where to build up from there.
Okay.
Now, you know, generally, again, you know, my recommendations is if the nests are out invisible, then you really prefer a liquid rather than a dust, because you can just soak the nest. And there are some even non-chemical liquids that foam them and the like. And you know, I've even taken a nest out when I was desperate with Formula 409, the cleaner.
Yeah.
And whereas if I can't see where the nest is, they're all disappearing under the siding or underneath a rock. That's where the dusts are more readily available. It may be it's a little easier for you to treat, as I said, if you can just get an aerosol and have some way of activating that tip, you know, with just pulling a knob or something, that may be a way of getting after it. And then the other way that the pest control guys will go after these sometimes is if you have a history of the north side of your house has wasp nests and the like, we know that things get started in the spring, typically May. They will go up and spray a residual chemical, much like we use for box elder bugs and the like, in the overhangs, in the crevices and all the little places they are, and you're basically heading them off at the pass before the queens get started. So really early is much more effective than trying to treat them when they're this late, when the colonies or numbers of critters involved are so much higher.
I understand that, and that right now I have another house on the farm here that has a great big, huge paper construction right where you access the front door.
Okay.
Nobody's been there for a while, and I just noticed it yesterday when I had an electrician up there doing some work.
Okay, well, there then I would just get, you know, they've got some stuff that'll shoot 8, 10, 15 feet, you know, and wait until about 8 o'clock at night and soak the base of that nest, and you should be done with it.
Really? Yeah. Will that be a contact poison or
yeah,
what?
Well, see, you know, so basically the stuff that is made as wasp and hornet killers typically have a very quick knockdown. Whereas the dust that I talked about, that's the one dilemma. They don't really,
right. We've
you know,
used that. We've used seven. And we've had a similar paper wasp nest my wife discovered in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, they were coming in where the air conditioner line goes in. We were able to do that with dust, with a short duster. But this is they have some sentry wasps out there that are on the
sure.
clock 24/7.
Right. Yeah,
And so I'm guessing I'd need a red light and.
No, I would still suggest don't do it in the day because the workers that are coming back won't be so happy at you. But if you wait until about 8 o'clock at night, so you've got enough light to work with, you know. And as I said, with these units shooting 8 to 10 feet and really very accurately, you don't have to get that close. And as soon as you get that spray or foam, in fact, I was using a foam like product yesterday when I was out and about and. It was instant. I mean, nobody was moving. Now, it was a small nest, but...
this thing is bigger than a football.
Yeah. No, and that's still not a problem. As I said, you will notice that the entrance is the base.
Right.
And you just start spraying and soaking that base. And then, you know, as you notice that nothing or the ones that will be falling out, you can spray up in there. But usually, if you get a good soaking on the base, that's all that it takes, and you're done.
All right.
Okay.
Good
all
luck, Greg.
Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have so many photos on our Facebook page. Phil, let's go there, and we've got this beautiful insect from Alex.
Yeah, so that is a particular dragonfly that I know as the green darner, Anax junius. And it is an interesting one because it does migrate up here, although there is some evidence that we also have breeding populations of it. It's one of the biggest dragonflies in Wisconsin, and they're just stunning.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And, you know, we're talking a critter, you know, from... tip of tail and whatnot, it's approaching 4.5 inches.
Yeah, that's from Alex. And then Valerie sent us a shot. What do we got here?
So that's a group of flies that we call robber flies, and they're very diverse. They're predators, and they will catch all kinds of other insects. And some of them look like bumblebees. Some of them look like fine grasshoppers to me. I mean, I said
this
it's just
looks
a very
like a grasshopper
interesting
a
group. There is a site that has most of the robber flies of Wisconsin. If you do robber flies in Wisconsin, you'll get it, and they're pictured, and they'll give you a little bit more detail. Again, a very interesting group, rather large. I mean, some of the robber flies will approach, again, 2.5-3 inches in length, so they're pretty robust insect. But as I said, if you watch them, usually they'll sit and rest, and then when a gnat or something else comes by that gets their interest, they'll go and grab it and then start chomping on it. So.
And we got a caterpillar. Not sure about this one.
Well, this one, here's where Phil, you know, not being in the lab for a while, this is a Texas moth, and I be it for the life of me, I still can't come up with the name of it, but it's an interesting one because we didn't see much activity till about 4 years ago. It started showing up on lupin, among other things. It's also found in California and Arizona, so it's kind of a diverse critter, but it's rather host specific. So as I said, unfortunately, I'm going to have to get back to my computer and pick the name up, and I can pass it back on to you. But as I said, it's a rather unique thing, and it's been one of these ones that you're kind of juggling. Are they breeding here now, or is it just always a migration up? My colleague up in the University of Minnesota, Jeff Hahn, had told me that he had never seen it until about 2 years ago. They had no records of that animal at all. But now it's showing up on a regular basis, which to me is a real kind of curious observation.
Yeah, absolutely. And Emery sent one, too. This is from
Emery Green takes Bay. Neat pictures. Emery would send me all kinds of neat dragonfly pictures when I was in the lab.
And this is a beautiful shot.
It's a neat grasshopper. I know it's a shorthorn, but without my keys, I'm a little bit perplexed. Now, again, the DNR and Charles Bomar, who was up in the west central part of the state, published a Grasshoppers of Wisconsin, and the keys there could work it through the other place. But you know what makes it a little tough is that the color schemes can be a little variable. So you get into other subtleties to try to properly identify the number of spines on a particular section of the body and the like. And as I said, so that's why other than knowing it is a shorthorn grasshopper, the family, the acritids, I really don't know what species. But if Emery can chase that down, as I said, I mean, if I get a chance again, when I get my grasshopper book out, I can see if I can do something with it.
And then Katie sends us something that I'm trying to remember, one of the Star Wars movies where there was a kind of a slug-like person thing, whatever it was, and this kind of looks like that.
Well, this is the caterpillar of the tiger swallowtail, and it has the two eye spots on the top. Yeah. You will see both a green and a brown form of this, and if you poke it, there'll be a little red tongue-like structure that comes out, which it's emitting a chemical, which it uses for its defense, so it's a very neat critter. I will say I've seen more tiger swallowtails this year than I have in the last 2 or 3 years. It's been a pretty good butterfly year. I mean, last year we were lamenting about it was not a good butterfly year. But this year, as I said, now maybe being retired, I'm getting outside a little bit more to enjoy this. But giant swallowtails, tiger swallowtails, black swallowtails, I've seen them all in the last week.
And here's something that Chris and her husband found in their car. I have never seen anything like that.
It's a perspective thing. I was kind of looking at it, and I was trying to figure out what's front and what's back. The more I look at it, I think it's slightly out of focus, but that is a cicada, and it was emerging from the ground as a nymph, and now the adults are coming out. So the greenest portion is the adult, but the wings have not unfurled completely. The brownest portion is the old cast skin of the nymph that is attached there, and if it's still alive, I would assume in a matter of a couple hours from when you took this picture, the wings would have formed properly and it would have flown off.
And here's one from Paul. We had this eyed click beetle.
Right.
Which is
one of the trophies if you're a beetle collector in the state. Critters upwards of about 2 inches in length. We have a lot of click beetles, but most of them are small and kind of unimpressive. But this one is downright stunning with those eye spots. And that's what they are, is just spots. They're not functional to seeing. Some people would argue that they use this as a defense mechanism. I'm not sure on some of these times. I think sometimes we overthink these, but it sure could be. And there are some impressive similar species in the tropics. But that is the eyed click beetle. The larvae are found in dead and dying trees, in wood, and usually you don't see them. So once in a while, they'll be attracted to lights at night. That's probably the best shot that somebody has got to see one if they really want to see it.
Boy, we've got some. As you listen to the show, you might go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and take a look at some of these photos. There's just absolutely great photos of insects. Kate in Madison had a question for you. Kate, thanks for calling.
I have a question about a little tiny black bug or bugs that when I put out soft cat food seem to come around the soft cat food, not the kibble. And they seem to hop all around. I don't see them flying, really. And they move so fast, I can't catch one to send in a sample. I've never seen them before.
Hmm. The hopping's got me bothered because that doesn't fit really much what I see indoors. I mean, there are some, you know, carpet beetles and other things that would get into cat food, and some like higher protein food than others. But usually there's stuff that's already in the food. How long would you say the food sits out before the critters show up?
Maybe if the cat doesn't eat it the first day, maybe the second day.
Hmm. Oh, that's fast.
I've learned to put out small amounts.
Mm-hmm.
Try to prevent it, but I moved into a different apartment and I've never seen it before.
Yeah, you might consider getting some double-sided sticky tape and just put it on the bowl or whatnot to see if you can capture a couple, and then you can send it in. As I said, you know, one of the things in the back of my mind is I wonder if they're drain flies, because drain flies are fuzzy little critters. They kind of hop at times. It's really a jump in a fly at the same time, but it's, as I said, but on the other hand, even though, you know, I even see drain flies in my own house at times, I don't necessarily associate them with cat food. I mean, it usually damper areas, I would expect them. So as I said, I'm a little puzzled in it, but I think if you at all can stop one with some tape, as I said, then we can get you a proper ID.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. A Facebook question from Jennifer: would grasshoppers enjoy eating broccoli and cabbage? I tried my hand at fall planting of both, and the leaves have been completely chewed up or gone. And what would be the best way to avoid the issue going forward? It's a community garden, so it's a shared garden.
It would surprise me. I would expect many other things in the garden to be hit much worse than the broccoli and stuff, because there are mustard oils in cabbage that offer that plant quite a bit of protection. And although you'd see a little nip and a taste, nutritionally, I can't believe it. And as I said, if the grasshoppers are that bad, when you walk, they should be flushing like quail. I mean, just critters all over. And if you just see an occasional one, you know, by far the biggest stinker for cabbage and broccoli are the little green worms, the white cabbage butterflies. And, you know, give them 3 or 4 days when they're getting towards the end of their larval stage and things disappear in front of your eyes. So, as I said, when I hear defoliation, that would be the first critter group I would suspect. There's a couple of beetles that show up once in a while and do a little bit. But as I said, if I'm talking about down to the veins, I'm thinking of caterpillars.
Yeah. I was thinking back now to walking along the edge of one of the community gardens that it's in our neighborhood and seeing all the white little...
Oh, they're having... My neighbor has a cabbage. My grandson has fun. He calls them mollies. He's giving them a name. They're mollies. But that's... Yeah, they're having a good year, and they always do. I mean, that is one of the most dependable insects you know. If you grow cabbage in the late summer, they will come.
There's a call from Tom in Viroqua next. Hi, Tom.
Yes, good morning. I absolutely agree with Phil on his observation on butterflies. I've seen more butterflies, more variety, even more monarchs, which are supposed to be in decline, that I remember since child. I mean, it's just been a wonderful summer for that. And my question is I heard recently that the DNR has either suspended or at least cut back on its spraying for gypsy moths this year. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether Phil thinks there's a connection there.
Yeah, really not. And the DNR is really very careful, and the Department of Ag, when they are looking into areas in deciding if they should treat, one of the questions they ask is there are any endangered butterflies, like, you know, where we have the Karner blues. They will not treat with bacterial insecticides, which kill caterpillars. What they do use sometimes, in fact, they use in a lot of areas, are more of these mating disruptors that are basically goofs up the male gypsy moth so he can't find a female to mate with. So that should have no effect. But the other thing that why I don't think even the BT products have much effect is they're spraying at a time of the year when most of the butterflies are not in a susceptible stage. I mean, for BT to kill a caterpillar, it has to be there and usually in a relatively small larval state and within a week or less of when that treatment is done. And they're spraying trees, and we have very few butterflies that utilize oak trees as a host plant. And that's basically what they're spraying is oaks in many cases. And so, as I said, the people that are involved with the spray programs, do have to basically file environmental impact statements when they're trying to decide. But I've never been overly concerned because, you know, many of our butterflies have not emerged yet or are going to migrate up here or are in the egg stage and wouldn't be susceptible. So.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Tom. Dave in Strum, Wisconsin. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there, Larry. Hello, Mr. Pelletieri. I'm glad that you're on today for at least 2 weeks now. Myself and my fellow rural mail carriers have been waiting for you to appear on the show because we have been observing a phenomenon that none of us have really seen, at least this amount of before, in the mailboxes. Mm-hmm. Moths, a dark, dark gray moth, mm-hmm. grayish brown. And I've hauled mail for over 20 years, and I've never seen anything like I have this year. I'd say the peak was maybe a week to 2 weeks ago. We had to open a mailbox door, and some of them, the amount of moths in there were worthy of a Hitchcock film. I've just never seen that phenomenon. I was wondering if you had any idea what type of moth.
I can give you the name of the family, but boy, I'd like to see the individual because it would be interesting.
Okay, I think I can catch one.
Okay, so, you know, the biggest group of moths that we have are the noctuids, which are technically cutworm moths, and there is a good 300 or 400 species in the state. Generally speaking, most of them are grays and blacks.
This would be kind of grayish black.
And upwards of an inch, maybe even an inch and a half long. And
that would be it.
And many times in the day, they would, you know, rest on the bark of trees, but they also congregate in shaded areas, just laying low until the night when that's when they're out and about and looking for mates and the like. And so just be curious. And, you know, you get certain years, you get outbreaks of individual species. And it may just be that you've got one that has a particular fondness for shady mailboxes. But
it must be because I've never seen an amount of moss like that.
Yeah, it's what's so fascinating is, as I said, you'll find a year that you'll get an outbreak of a particular species. You might not see it for 15 years ago. I mean, you might see a couple here or there, but as I said, what fuels these individual outbreaks? And if it's not something of economic significance, as I said, it's something that we probably haven't studied all as closely as something that has caused a lot of crop damage and the like. But they said, I'm pretty confident that it's probably the underwing moths are a particular subgroup of these that are really quite stunning because they have yellows and pinks and reds in their hind wings. But some of them are very drab.
Quite drab.
Yeah. So it's definitely a cutworm, but as I said, if you can get a halfway decent picture of even a moth at rest, I probably get my hold of my friend Kyle Johnson, who is just the best moth person I know, and usually just by sight of a picture like that, he can give us a species.
Know right away.
Kyle just got back from his excursion in Alaska. To entertain himself, he spent 8 weeks running around Alaska collecting insects, and it shows you what kind of dedication he's got.
Oh, man, I guess.
Yes.
Well, Dave.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And thanks to actually, I always have a big thank you to the rural mail carriers. I get a lot of mail from rural mail carriers who listen to the show. And, you know, it's something you can do while you're in your car delivering the mail.
Yes.
Exactly. We all enjoy you, Larry. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks a lot for calling. They're good people. My father-in-law was he's retired now, rural mail carrier for many a years, Herb Stoudy. Pat in East Troy, you are next. You know what? Dick in Waukesha is next because I pushed the wrong button. So we'll go to Pat, you're after Dick. Hi, Dick. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. I was in a bomber group over in England during World War II, and our mess hall was in nice weather. They opened the windows, and there was one of those 8-seat places.
Yeah.
And about now, the yellow jackets started swarming, and the people would swat at them, and every now and then somebody'd get stung. And then one day a fella brought a couple of plates of marmalade and put on the desk on the tables, and from then on, those marmalade plates were loaded with yellow jackets getting drunk on, I guess, on marmalade.
And left you alone.
They left us alone.
Mm-hmm.
So that's nice for a picnic in the backyard or anywhere.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting. the German yellow jacket, which moved into our state in the late 70s, became the major stinker. And so that probably was the species you were dealing with in Europe, because that's the native range of that critter.
Uh-huh.
And it is
it
such
looks
a...
kind of like ours, but...
Yeah, it's a very much a food scavenger for both sweets and proteins.
Yeah.
And my colleague Bob Jean and his students that worked with it found out... It was a little surprising. We know honeybees can communicate to other bees where there's a food source, how good it is, which direction to fly. Well, somewhat with yellow jackets, maybe not at the same level of sophistication, but what Bob and his students found is that they would become habituated to a particular food. So if all of a sudden they got into the marmalade, they had this focus on marmalade, and they just keep coming there. And why this has been of some interest is that, you know, a number of companies have looked at ways of baiting wasps with the idea that we give them something they like, they take it back and feed the other wasps, and we get control. But they've never been able to crack this one because they can change their focus. And, you know, I know Bob and some of the people down at the University of Indiana had found that fresh cooked ham was probably the best of the bunch for attracting yellow jackets. But as it dried out, it lost its activity. But what Bob and his students found is if you found a nest and you put this fresh cooked ham very close by, if they were going to the marmalade that was 200 yards down the road, they keep going to the marmalade. I mean, it's not as if they would refocus. Yeah. And so he said that was a fascinating thing to understand. So I suspect that's what happened is you got a few of them addicted to the marmalade. And after that, that was
there
the secret.
Are.
Now, I will tell you that...
Too bad marmalade wouldn't work on the German Air Force.
Well, the interesting thing, you know, the German yellow jacket numbers in the last few years have been down. I mean, I equate when my kids were growing up, we could not picnic right now outside without being attacked. And boy, it's been a couple years now that I could see an occasional one at best, not 20 every time you sit outside with a bologna sandwich in your hand. And, you know, their populations have seemed to decline. And, you know, I know Dr. Jean speculated that there probably are some diseases that are helping do that. And probably for the best, because that particular creature, when it moved into an area, the number of stings went up by a factor of fivefold.
Oh.
So a lot of times when people talk about being allergic to bees, it's not bees, it's yellow jackets, because they're far more likely, especially late summer, early fall, to be in contact with people. And again, they have kind of an edgy disposition. So.
No doubt about it. Dick, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and with UW Extension. Pat in East Troy has been waiting patiently. Pat, thanks for waiting. Hi.
It was worth the wait. I have a problem in an unoccupied a house built on a slab next to Lake Beulah. I have cellar spiders everywhere. They've outgrown their designation as cellar. They're all over this house, and every time I walk in there, which is usually on a daily basis, I get a face full of their webs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't enjoy it. I wish I had a solution. I have a choice, I think, either a bomb, a spray, or a vacuum cleaner.
And I think the vacuum is the best. I think the vacuum is honestly the best. Bombs really don't do much for spiders. Sprays even, you know, the way they function and the like, because most spiders, relatively speaking, are slow to breed. What you find is if you go through, and it's kind of hands and knees at times, getting back in all the corners and the like, and removing the spiders themselves, it takes them quite a bit of time to recover. You know, so I'm not going to say this is a permanent solution, but boy, you'd think if you dedicated once and at most twice a year to some time of just really getting underneath things, make sure there's the less clutter around, the less places for them to hide, the better. But as I said, I find the vacuum cleaner with an attachment and getting back in all those nooks and crannies is going to probably be the most effective that I can think of.
Well, thank you. I was hoping for an easy way out, but it makes good sense.
Get the vacuum cleaner out, Pat.
It's already out.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. Carolyn on Facebook wondered, and she used to hear crickets chirping in her area of suburban Milwaukee. Doesn't anymore. It's been a decline. Has there been a decline in the population of crickets?
If they've got habitat, no. I mean, I have noticed when I'm out in fields and wild areas, there's crickets just everywhere. Yeah. And so normally, and I used to get complaints of crickets migrating in, and it's usually somebody had a big grassland next to them and the like, so they had the right habitat. I think it probably is more land use changes in what's going on around you. And mowed lawns, honestly, are kind of insect deserts.
Yeah.
I mean, there really is not a lot. They're often drier than people think as far as the insects are concerned, not a lot of good hiding places. And so I think that's probably it. As I said, if you get to the right place, the crickets are out. And in particular, I think are having at least average, if not better than average year this year.
Diane in Milwaukee could probably vouch for that.
Hi, thank you. I got a cricket in the house.
Mm-hmm.
He, she only chirps at night.
Mm-hmm.
Put the light on, he stops chirping. How long is this cricket going to live?
To be honest, it could go as late as December.
You are kidding.
No.
Yeah, and you can't find them. I had that same situation a while back. It drove me nuts.
Now, if you've got any idea, if he's kind of like underneath a washing machine or something like that, that might not be easy to get to.
No, he's in a bedroom right off the kitchen.
Okay.
Yeah.
When I get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, he chirps. Mm-hmm. I put the light on, he stops chirping.
Yeah. My gut feeling is, you know, I kind of gave you the worst case scenario because inside there really is very little for them to eat to sustain themselves, so one would think that it would succumb quite a bit quicker than that. But I will tell you, I've definitely run into cases where they migrate in the late summer, and it's an awful long time before they finally settle down.
Oh, boy. But am I going to be worried about more babies?
No. There's no way they can breed indoors. They, you know, much like grasshoppers, they have to lay their eggs in the soil, and then they hatch next spring, and, yeah, you just don't have the conditions.
Okay, that's good. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Diane. Oh, that just, I had it in my bedroom, too. This is years ago, but I've not forgotten it because that thing would chirp and chirp and chirp and chirp, and you turn the light on, and of course, it stops. It was in a closet, and it wasn't that big a closet. I couldn't find it.
Yeah, no.
I practically tore that closet apart. Marty in LaPointe, thanks a lot for calling.
Hi, she's what?
We're doing great.
Good. I love the discussion. I got a couple questions. One, there's been a lot of talk about yellow jackets and honeybees, but no talk about the dreaded bald-faced hornet. They are like the ferocious tigers of the flying bee family. And if you could talk about controlling them, we had a nest that we tore down, and they actually worked to put the nest back together. They were so so intent on keeping it. And the other thing was, the use of praying mantises for pest control. A few years ago, I had a couple praying mantis eggs, and I left them a little too long, and they started cannibalizing on each other. And then I let them go into the garden, and I had no problems. I had no problems with insects at all. So the use of praying mantises as a viable pest control, and I will certainly take my responses off air.
It'd be interesting. You know, mantids are not native here, but in the last 10 years, they have been breeding in the southern part of the state. Although my question, because they overwinter as eggs that were very exposed, is how they did with this past winter. And I have not seen evidence if they're around or not. I guess I sometimes maybe disappoint people in that mantids eat things that help. So they'll eat a grasshopper, but they'll also eat a honeybee. They will not eat an aphid. They will not eat a spider mite. And so they're somewhat selective in what they feed on. And for that reason, I never consider them covering all the bases you need as far as a beneficial insect. They definitely don't hurt anything. But as I said, it may just be the coincidence that you have not had critters get out of hand, because they said they're somewhat specialized in feeding on bigger things. And they don't distinguish between a butterfly and a grasshopper. So you could even argue sometimes they're feeding things you don't want.
Sure.
Now, the bald-faced hornet, you know, probably the most infamous because the size of the colonies, you know, the basketball and bigger nests sitting up in the trees. And usually what I try to get people to think through is that we know that the colony will die out by the 1st of November. And so if it's an area that there is no people traffic, you know, 20 feet up in a tree, leave them alone, because you really do run the biggest risk of getting stung when the nest is threatened. Now, if one is sitting 4 feet high in the bush and you got to go by with your riding lawnmower, this is not good, because they really do respond very defensively if they feel threatened. And then they're very efficient. In fact, I'm not sure if this is scientifically valid, but they seem to have heat sensors. They don't mistake and sting you in their clothes. They get you where forehead and other things. I mean, they really concentrate in where it hurts a lot. And so as far as if it's in a bad spot, and it will never be in the ground. It's always an above-ground nester. But if it's in a bad spot, those aerosol sprays are great. And again, you judge it on people and pet traffic. One of the more interesting cases I had in my career, in fact, is one I've definitely will be putting in the book, was having a conversation on the phone in the lab with a gentleman who had one sitting up on a great big light post. You know, so again, it sounded, but as we're talking, I hear this loud bang, and then he goes, "Oh my goodness." And it turned out the neighbor came out with a 410 shotgun and shot the nest. Oh. And there was a bunch of kids out there watching all this commotion. And of course, people were getting stung. It was not a good situation.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I think when you destroyed the nest, what happened is the queen was not killed, you know, and there was enough workers that survived and they will try to regroup. In nature, they have a lot of trouble with skunks and sometimes raccoons because they will tear those nests open to get after the grubs. Great protein source for the wildlife and the like. And they seem to tolerate the stings, which is really quite amazing because you can imagine when you've got a couple hundred yellow jackets trying to defend the nest, what kind of war is going on. And so this is about the time of the year you'll start to see that. If you had a big nest you're observing, all of a sudden you wake up one morning and it's on the ground and torn apart. As I said, you start to wonder about raccoons and skunks going after them. But so I always judge them. They're beneficial when they prey, especially on caterpillars and other things. So the bald-faced hornets are eating some pest species. And so that's a good part. Houseflies, they like to feed on houseflies. It's just that when they get in a bad place, you got to deal with them.
Thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, he's going to be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet, and then we will be back with Phil. You stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. No matter what the season, there are countless insects around us, and we're talking about those insects today with Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist who's distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the UW-Madison and UW Extension. And, of course, Phil, always great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
We have lots of callers online. You may have a question about an insect in your neighborhood. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Or if you've got a photo, please post it on my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. There are already lots of good ones. We've been talking about them, and there are more to talk about. So it's always fun to look through the Facebook page at those photos that you have. Paul and Gordon, though, has been waiting quite a while online, so let's go there. Paul, thanks for waiting.
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Well, we have quite a few balsam trees in our yard. We live on a lake, and the trees themselves are starting, some of them randomly, part of the branch dies on the end, and then we've had some of them which started and then they died totally. And I pulled the trees. But recently we had a 35-foot balsam that over the course of approximately, I'm estimating, maybe a week or two, died totally. And the needles were falling off. That's how we first noticed it. So we've removed the tree. However, I don't know. It's obviously, that seems to be some kind of an insect, we're thinking, or perhaps it's some other kind of disease.
Yeah. Conifers are always quite hard to work with because oftentimes they're in trouble and you don't see it. And once they brown, of course, they're so far gone. My inclination is that most of the insects I see on firs are secondary, meaning they're attacking dead and dying trees. So they give the impression that they may be the cause, but instead they're more of an effect. And so I'm inclined to suspect a disease, but I'm really kind of a little bit of a loss. I don't know if there's a Colorado. Has there been major fluctuations in water levels in the last 10 years or construction or something else that we can point to that might have started this decline?
No. We built the house that we're living in 2000.
Okay.
And we just noticed this particular disease happening in the last, I'm going to guess, 4 to 5 years, was not necessarily of a concern until this one very large tree died, mm-hmm. and we could hear some kind of an insect. In the particular tree that we just took down.
Yeah. Oh, no, and I know who that is. That there's a critter that we call a pine sawyer, S-A-W-Y-E-R. And these are large longhorn wood-boring beetles. And you can hear them chewing in the tree. You can see sawdust getting pushed out.
Yep.
So as I said, they give you the impression that, oh, my goodness, this is a big, large insect. Look at the damage. But it's in the tree because it's dying. It's or dead already, or a lot of times I get these out of logs where people will drop the logs, leave them in the woods for the summer. They become infected then, and then they build log homes out of them, and guess who comes out within the next year or two is one of these great big beetles. So, as I said, they just underline the effect that there's something that's really stressing the devil out of these trees, and that's, you know, it may be worth, if you've got a number of really valuable trees on the property, is getting an arborist to come in and assess it. He may have to send something off to a lab to see if they can diagnose, you know. I mean, it sounds vascular. It sounds root. It sounds,
you know,
systemic. But there's just not enough to go in to do more than that. But I think it's definitely worth looking because, as I said, I'm not necessarily worried about something contagious, but I'm worrying about a situation that's weakening the trees, and then if there's something you can do to stop that so the remaining trees can stay strong and avoid all this problem.
Okay, I did contact the DNR in our area yesterday, and they said there were some people on another lake that had not seen the sawyer, what you just described, but the same browning of the end of the balsams, and they were sending it off someplace because they were at a loss as to what it was.
Okay. Well, then, and again, and I suspect a good possibility the samples are going down to the plant disease lab that Brian Huddleston, my colleague, runs. And as I said, because those are the kind of things that they have to look to see if they can find something in the vascular system. So they're basically doing some tests if they can identify what the pathogen is involved. But it definitely sounds more disease-like to me than it does. They said, my gut is the insects are secondary.
Yeah, and you could probably take, if you've got a branch, let's say, that's part infected and part not, if you could send a piece of that to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic that Phil just mentioned, and Brian Huddleston will take a look at it, send it on a Monday or a Tuesday, and you'll get an answer. Or, you know, you go to get a certified applied arborist. A certified arborist can probably take a look at it and may have the answer for you that way. I'd certainly would work with an arborist that it's certified, though.
Yeah. You know, and the thing about it is, you know, if this was 5 or 6 years ago, and again, with some of the significant droughts we had up north, it was kind of an accumulation. But in general, the last couple of years have been a little bit better for moisture levels up there. And so, if anything, things should be turning around on some of these stressed trees. But as I said, I think at least things are heading the right direction, and hopefully the DNR people will get some answers. And then, depending on what that is you look at what your options are.
Yeah, make sure your trees are getting plenty of water. If it's been dry, I mean, that's one thing. You want to try and keep them healthy, and water would certainly be a help if it's been dry. Good luck, Paul. Thanks for calling. And again, the Insect Diagnostic Lab, the Insect Disease Diagnostic Lab. If you put UW Disease Diagnostic Lab in your search engine, it's going to pop up and you're going to be able to get to it. And Dave in Wausau, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I hate to go back to the wasps again.
That's all right.
I help organize early to mid-September festival, Downtown Wasps. It's an art festival, and lots of people out on the street. And some years the wasp problem is very bad, and some years it's not, because I understand, you know, all the conditions that would affect that. But maybe you can just tell me, verify, or is it actually efficient to put something on? I mean, these are two-story buildings with access to the roofs, and people have talked about this for years. I don't know anybody that's actually tried it. To put something on these roofs that would either attract the wasps there or trap them. You know, I'm not necessarily interested in killing them, but to keep them down off the street away from the little kids and stuff. Is there any efficacy involved in doing something like that?
I mean, I've seen a little bit to suggest if you start this very early in the season and you stress the colonies out, they grow slower. If they grow slower, they're less likely to become scavengers. But in general, it's not that good of a suggestion. And definitely this late, you're not gaining. You're not gaining. So, as I said, if I had to give you a gut feeling, I'm thinking that things aren't going to be as bad as it was 6-7 years ago. I have not seen a big swing in the last 5 years in particular. The numbers have been way down, and I don't see anything to suggest otherwise.
So it might be an easy year this fall, huh?
Well, that no. And you know what I would suggest is some of the proactive things is wherever you have trash containers and the like that are out now. As I said, if you're already drawing them into an area, you're starting behind the eight ball. So, you know, anything that can be done to empty trash containers on a regular basis.
And also get ones that'll cover.
Yeah, you need to cut the excess. So, you know, the Babcock Ice Cream Parlor is right across from the Russell Labs where the diagnostic lab is. And, you know, we have people drinking and eating ice cream and throwing stuff in. And, you know, once they went to the covers with the swinging doors so the wasp could not get access, it really improved the situation dramatically. But everybody's
got... I'm always managing the location of the dumpsters distract them, and I'll admit that it is somewhat entertaining to watch the difference between people who panic and people who don't.
Yeah.
But thank you. I appreciate that. I won't waste any effort than trying to put vats of honey on the roofs.
Okay.
But do get those trash receptacles covered.
Yeah, and even with the trash containers, you know, if at all possible, get them clean before people throw up. As I said, if you've got a lot of spillage and stuff on the outside, it's just like a magnet, and you draw them in. And, of course, you can keep the containers as far away from people as possible. But, as I said, the less food that's available before you start, the less of a habit they'll have of coming in. And, you know, we had the same problem in Camp Randall, you know, with everybody in the early football games. And, you know, the one thing that the gentleman that was in charge of pest control, and he had the time to do it on campus, is he would literally go hunt nests out. And the way he would do this is he would take some pop like Mountain Dew and put it out in a pie plate. Uh-huh. The Yellow Jackets find it, and rather than killing them, he would watch where they fly to. Once they got a belly full of pop, he would watch. And you know, many of these nests are quite secretive because they're going underneath a juniper bush and they're in the ground. But once he found the nest and treated, he's taking out a couple thousand rather than one or two individuals like
at
you
a
do
time.
With it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, by going through and removing five or six nests from Camp Randall made a major difference. And so sometimes, again, if somebody's got some time the curiosity, that to me is a more efficient method of trying to reduce the localized populations. Because most of the time when they're foraging, it's within a couple hundred yards. The nest is in a couple hundred yards of where you're finding them.
So just as an aside that doesn't relate very much, I was on a board, the athletic board, and one of the committees involved with overseeing Camp Randall. And the amount of ambulance calls to Camp Randall had gone up considerably. And the reason, and frankly, if you get stung by a bee there, that's the greatest place in the world to be. Within a minute, you're going to have somebody there with an EpiPen. But the reason for the increase they figured out finally was that the team got so much better. back in the day when the team wasn't very good, if you didn't feel good, you didn't go. You just said, "Oh, the heck with it." But now, when the team's better, people say, "Okay, I'm going."
Yeah. Well, and it's definitely for those of us who grew up here, and you know, I've got a few years under the belt. It was not the same when we were kids. They said this German Yellow Jacket really did change, and you know, I've seen figures to suggest a third of the people coming in to the emergency rooms in the fall were from Yellow Jacket stings in bad years.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I have not heard of recently. And as I said, at least my observations this far into August, I'm not seeing them yet, which is quite encouraging. Because in a bad year, it could start as early as the 1st of August.
Judy in Lodi, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Hi to your guests. I've had problems for the last 8 years with box elder. Now I've got flies. But there's two varieties. One has got like a green back on it that bites. And they're all over.
Okay, so the green back makes sense. The bottle flies, the blue bottles, the green bottles, and then the flesh flies are critters that we often get outbreaks of But what does not make sense is they are not a biting fly. In fact, they're a fly that's associated with either dead animals. So sometimes, you know, an animal will die in the wall and you get this.
We had Orkin here because somebody had mentioned they saw rats. Mm-hmm. So this guy put some kind of dusting down in all the holes and killed all the little animals, which I'm very, very upset about.
Okay.
And since then, I've got flies, and my apartment's on the ground floor. There's nothing under me. On the outside of the building is just concrete blocks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if anything dies, which I've been smelling these horrible smells, I get the flies like crazy.
Crazy, yeah.
Right. Well, the good news is at least it's going to be short-term because these kind of flies can be seem to explode within 5-6 days of the animal dying, but very quickly the carcass dries out and it's no longer suitable. So it's one of these things. If you knew where the carcass was, you clean it up, the problem's gone. If you can't find it, it's not worth ripping the walls apart, but it will subside usually in a week or two is usually the time frame.
Good luck. Thank you very much, Judy, for calling. I appreciate it. So you're just going to have to wait.
Yeah, it's really the only practical thing, unless you know, your nose tells you where it is, and as I said, it's accessible.
Rick in Green Bay has a question. Hi, Rick. Oh, let's see if I can get Rick on here. Huh. Oh, I just somehow managed to lose Rick. I don't know what happened. We lost the entire, we lost all our calls.
Looks like you got me working the board, Larry.
I don't know what happened there, but anyway, we'll get some calls back for sure. People are going to call back. We had Andrew email us and says, I have an older home with a rubble stone foundation. I have an invasion of winged small ants coming in around basement stairs, appear to be trying to get outside. Any ideas?
So the wing forms are the reproductives. He's seeing a swarm in different ant swarm at different times of the year, and he's probably right. They're trying to get outside. What's interesting is some of the ants that do this, this is the only time you see them is when they swarm. They're not ants that come in the kitchen or bother you and the like. The citronelle ant is one particular form that we see quite a bit that does that. So, one of the options is just that 3 or 4 days that the ants are flying, you get the vacuum cleaner and have at them. If you were trying to look for a more permanent remedy, this is a case that you'd probably have to get a professional pest control service to come in because the product that is most effective against ants is not an easy product to find on the shelves. It's not sold typically to homeowners, but there are some products that they can put down that have the kind of residual that one treatment would control it. But as I said, to me, it's if the ants are only bothersome when you see the wing forms. Now, one of the arguments, if it's, one crack in the basement and that's the only place they come from, you see the crack. With a rubble foundation, I think the problem is there's just way too many nooks and crannies type of thing. And but again, one thing, look up larger yellow ant on the internet. That's what the citronella ant is. And you'll get quite a bit and see if it matches what you're seeing. But there's definitely other things. There's cornfield ants and pavement ants and the like. And some of the other ants that are a kitchen pest you can bait. But as I said, there are a handful of ants that don't respond to the baits, but they also don't cause us near as much problem.
Well, I'm back to the Facebook page, and the coolest photo here of a birdhouse, or she said, this is from Nancy, she said, this used to be a birdhouse. Oh, you got to see this.
Yeah, so definitely it's a paper wasp. We have about seven or eight species.
It's built over a birdhouse.
Yeah, and of course, the birds have no option anymore. They've basically been evicted, But the interesting thing is, by the 1st of November, this will die out because these kind of species have no food stores. I mean, that's what makes honeybees special is they've got honey that they utilize to generate heat all winter long to keep themselves alive because of that heat. But all the yellow jackets and bumblebees die out except for the queens, and they have to start everything from scratch the next year. So really kind of interesting. One of my favorite pictures of a paper wasp nest is down on campus. Back in the day when I was young, we used to have movie posters of all different colors. Well, the yellow jackets would chew those off and then go to make their nest. And so we had some nests on campus that would have blue bands, pink bands, yellow bands, just very artistic.
Very beautiful.
It's kind of fun to watch.
And here we've got Leslie sent us a photo. I wonder what kind of butterfly is this? It's a black with some kind of a white bands across.
So this one is called the giant swallowtail.
Uh-huh.
And it breeds on prickly ash in Wisconsin. And if you're familiar with prickly ash, it's not your favorite thing to have in the woods.
No.
But that's in the citrus family. So down in Florida, this is called the citrus dog because this particular swallowtail butterfly is a not a major, but a bit of a pest on citrus plants because that's the host plants of the caterpillars. But up here, as I said, we just see them, I think, more common on the western edge of the state. But, you know, I've had people even as far as Green Bay running into them. A neat critter, definitely a neat critter.
And what do we got here? Well, let's see. Oops.
Okay, so the one white, from
whitish
Terrell is that is a noctuid moth, and it's a particular group. And again, without my moth book, I can't unfortunately give you the name. But at rest, what appears to be out the front that you might mistake for antennae are really its front pair of legs. And then the coloration of this moth, it's often assumed that they're trying to look like a bird dropping, so they're rather well camouflaged when they're resting like this. But they're really quite attractive, and really, if you look carefully at the forewings, there are some pretty little blue spots and the like. That's one of my favorite moths. So,
and here we've got, what do we got here from Zach, who says, to the guy wanting a good wasp spray, this is what is issued to us at work and works very well. Also has nice a range so you can get away from it. So
yeah, and it, I said most of these things are made for quick knockdown and for petite people that are not comfortable with normal chemicals. There are some that have no true insecticides. I remember my colleague Chuck Koval walking in the lab one day with a can of wasp spray. He turned and he zapped me in my shirt and it looked like shaving cream. And I'm going, Chuck, what are you doing? And within about 5 seconds, it disappeared. But the interesting thing is this foam had an action. I don't know if it was the cooling effect or whatnot. It was sold as a wasp spray, and I had used it, and it was really very effective. So as I said, it might take a little digging, but for people who are not comfortable with normal kinds of wasp sprays, there are some alternatives out there that also work quite efficiently.
Another very pretty shot, a photo from Kevin. Found this Luna moth on my house.
Yeah, Lunas were, I mean, I've always envied people who get into Lunas because for some reason in Madison, they're not easy to come by, more common in the north. Kettle moraine seems to be, you know, if you're in the right place, sometimes they're quite common. We've got the right host plants. I mean, they feed on hickory and walnut, among other things, but they just aren't common. The other thing with all those wild silkworms is the adults are so short-lived, and the bats absolutely knock their populations around quite a bit. So I think they're more common than people think, but the bats tend to get them before you wake up in the morning and get a chance to take a look. So,
and one final one here. Julie Martinelli sent us a photo of the most coolest-looking wasp.
Or that's a moth. That's a hummingbird or sphinx moth is the family, the sphingids. This looks like the great poplar sphinx is the name given to this one. It's got these interesting green and of course, this kind of almost Star Wars-like wing pattern on these things.
Yeah, it looks like that. What's the plane that we have, the stealth bomber?
Yes.
It looks just kind of like a stealth bomber.
In this family, as I said, we've got well over 20 species, and they're just, all of them are neat. Some of them are quite a bit smaller than this, and even more spaceship-looking when you see them at rest, the blind sphinx and some of those other ones. So as I said, they're a fun group to see, and you know, other than the tomato hornworm, none of them are considered much of a pest. And even tomato hornworms, to be honest,
are
probably best hand-picked rather than doing anything else with them. So,
well, always a pleasure, Phil. Thank you so much. I look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good.
Thank you very much. Phil Pelletieri, our guest, will be back again. And we'll talk some more with him about insects. It's always so much fun when he's on. Please go take a look at my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You're going to see lots of interesting insect photos. Tomorrow, Nancy Zeman joins us to talk about Quilt Expo. And then Rick Cini shares travel advice, including why August 25th is a magic day for air travel. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.